General Boykin, you've played a role in almost every recent major American military operation in our generation. Let me mention the events, and I'd like you to give us your thoughts about them. You were a founding member of the Delta Force. It's a special unit of the military. Would you tell us about the training, the missions that these teams take part in?
Yeah, well, Skip, it's interesting that you ask that question because the Army has a stated policy of not talking about the Delta Force. They support making movies about it, and they actively recruit, but they don't officially acknowledge the Delta Force, but I think it's more than just an open secret. And the fact of the matter is that when the Delta Force was created in 1978, it was as a result of a series of events, hostage-taking events primarily, one of which was the German aircraft that was seized and taken into Mogadishu, Somalia. And the United States recognized that they did not have an expeditionary, deployable kind of organization that could go and run the kind of hostage rescue operations that would be required as this threat called terrorism began to really come onto everybody's radar screen. So fundamentally, in the 1978 period, Delta was created really to be a hostage rescue team, but it was always intended to morph into a much broader capability, and that's essentially what it is today. The early training was training that was essentially along the lines of not only law enforcement, SWAT team kinds of things, but also the kind of training that the notorious British Special Air Service had been doing for quite a number of years. And in fact, they were very instrumental in the organization and the early training of the Delta Force. So we came in and put this unit together and sort of mapped out our own way ahead and trained ourselves with some assistance from people like the FBI and the Secret Service and the British as well. And then ultimately we connected with the Germans and the French and the Israelis and others to help us refine our program.
You mentioned, General, Mogadishu. Was that when the U.S. involvement was there and General Idid was involved?
Well, that was a later mission for Delta. That actually occurred in 1993. In 1977, a German Lufthansa 737, I believe, was taken by one of the terrorist groups and ultimately flew into Mogadishu, and the German GSG-9, or the border guards, who had developed their own SWAT capability, went into Mogadishu and rescued a plane load of German hostages. And that sort of prompted Jimmy Carter to ask the question, do we have that capability? And being unsatisfied with the answer, he directed that that capability be developed.
I want to go to another event that is famous in our history. A lot of Americans never heard of Grenada till 1983, and then everybody around the world knew of it. President Reagan sent you and Delta Force into Grenada, where you were wounded at the time. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us about the event.
Well, the as you probably know, the Cubans had begun to build a runway there that would take the largest Russian jets, I probably should say Soviet at that time, and it became a real security issue for the entire hemisphere, and Reagan was concerned. But then when the 1,000 American medical students in the medical schools there on Grenada were suddenly under house arrest. Essentially, they were hostages. The president told us to spearhead the operation, to go into Grenada and rescue the American medical students, and then to turn the island back over to the people that had actually been elected to govern it and it had been taken away from them. As we came across the beautiful blue waters of the Caribbean there at just at sunrise, on the morning of the 25th of October, 1983, We saw our target. I was in the lead helicopter, and all of a sudden we started taking a lot of very heavy fire from the ground. They were firing 50 calibers and other anti-aircraft systems at us. We saw a lot of red and green tracers and that type of thing, and all of a sudden we started taking hits in our helicopter. And I was obviously trying to engage the enemy on the ground, and suddenly it felt as if someone had hit me with a 2x4, and I realized I'd been shot. And I was not sure whether I still had an arm or not, and I reached over and felt around until I found it and laid it across my lap, and then I realized I had a pretty serious injury. And so ultimately, we went out to a carrier where I was immediately taken into surgery. I had two big holes in me, one in the side of my chest and the other right up through the armpit. The arm was non-functional. And after a second surgery back at Fort Bragg, the doctors said, "You're never going to use your arm again." They said, "Your arm, the bone in your arm has been shot completely in two, and the nerves have been destroyed, and so that arm is never going to be used again." And they said, "We will go back in about 6 or 8 months and put some plates in it to repair the bones, but you're not going to use it again." I found out later that they actually wanted to take it off, but another doctor who knew me said, "Don't ask, he'll never agree to it." So, but I looked at them then, at the prompting of the Holy Spirit, and I said, "You know, you'll never go back in my arm again. God will heal me." And, of course, their response was, "Well, you certainly have a very positive attitude." And I thought, well, I don't think you quite understand. Now, you know, Skip, it was a painful recovery, but it was a miraculous recovery. Yeah. I had people praying for me, all over, the country. And even though it was very painful, physically painful, and it was frustrating, that arm that they were going to take off healed. And today, and I like to tell audiences, on my birthday every year I go in and rack up 300 pounds and bench press it just to show that this is the arm that they said I'd never use again. So,
General, what I'm just curious, what are soldiers trained to think like at a time in the battle when they get hit like you did? I know there's normal human reactions, but I know that soldiers are trained differently. What are you trained to react with or think like during those times?
Well, I think when you talk about a soldier's training, what I would tell you is that it becomes a teamwork drill. And soldiers are trained to work as teams. In other words, if your buddy is hit, you are trained in what the proper procedures are to try and save his life or limb, and how you apply, immediate aid to try and train your buddy. And I would not say that there is a lot of training on what do you do when you get wounded. It's sort of instinct. Mm. It really all kind of comes back to the teamwork effort. And you will see story after story of soldiers that have been wounded very severely and have continued to fight. And I would say that the training is really more focused on the teamwork and how to help your buddy when he gets hit than on what you do as an individual.
Hmm. A lot of our listeners will recognize the name Manuel Noriega. 1989, you were sent to Panama to apprehend that dictator.
That's correct, Skip. We went in. Actually, the larger mission was to actually take down his government and turn it back over to President Endara, who had been elected by the people of Panama. Part of that was to capture Noriega. He eluded us from the 20th of December 1989 until Christmas Eve of 89. And we actually surrounded him as he took refuge at the Catholic, or the Vatican Embassy, I should say, the Nunciatura there in Panama City. And it's I really find it interesting that a man who we saw the evidence of his Satan worship sought refuge at a holy place. So we surrounded him there, and I think we brought him out of there on about the 3rd of January.
Let's fast forward to 1980. I'll distinctly remember watching television with that attempted rescue of the American hostages in Iran. Tell us a little about that.
You know, when the Islamic Revolution began and the Shah was ousted from Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini returned rather triumphantly and ultimately supported the radical students there that seized our Americans at the U.S. Embassy. And by the way, as a footnote, three of those hostages, American hostages, were held over at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which was, you know, the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So they were not all in the embassy. And we were directed, Delta was, to spearhead the operation to go in and execute a rescue of those people. If you think back to 1980, we were really the only organized element of the task force that was put together. The rest of it was rather ad hoc. We worked very hard to prepare for the operation. We trained a lot. And we shrouded the entire operation in a very high level of secrecy. And ultimately, when we did launch the operation out of Wadi Kenya, Egypt, and from the carrier USS Nimitz, the plan was to link up about 100 miles from Tehran and offload all of our soldiers in the Delta Force from C-130s that would land in the desert, and then transload them onto RH-53 helicopters that came from the Nimitz. But before that could occur, we had to refuel the helicopters from the C-130s with large hoses and with fuel bladders inside. And as that refueling was occurring, one of the helicopters in the darkness and the dust and the confusion, as he was trying to reposition, the pilot, I think, went vertigo and crashed into the C-130. Now, inside that C-130 were 45 of the Delta operators. And what is significant about this is before we launched out of Wadi Kenya, we got all of those operators together. We prayed and asked God to go with us, and we sang God Bless America, committed ourselves to His care, and we launched that operation. When I looked up and saw that burning wreckage, and I was only about 50 feet from it when it exploded, I knew instinctively that all 45 of those men were dead. I knew they couldn't survive. They were engulfed in nothing but a ball of flames. They were sitting inside the C-130 on fuel bladders. There were fumes everywhere. It was going to explode, and they were going to die. And in my desperation, I began to do the only thing that I knew I could do, and I began to call on the name of Jesus, and I prayed, you know, one of those very powerful 10-second prayers, asking God to spare their lives. And all of a sudden, the troop door on the right side of the C-130 opened, and 45 men hit the desert floor at a dead run.
Wow.
And it's like the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, they came through that fire, and not a single one of those men that prayed at Wadi Kenya, Egypt, and asked God to keep them in His hands, was injured.
Wow. What a testimony. That's fabulous. I know that a lot of us Christians in the West, we read our Bibles and we speak about spiritual warfare. You must relate a little bit differently than the average Joe when it comes to hearing the term spiritual warfare. And I just wondered if you wouldn't care to give our audience a little bit of, from your perspective, a little bit of encouragement when it comes to spiritual warfare, what the differences are between spiritual and physical warfare, and how you relate what you've seen to spiritual lessons.
Yeah, you know, and thank you very much for that question, Skip, because I do talk to audiences quite frequently about this issue. It has, it's difficult for people, particularly in America, to come to grips with the realities that we have a real enemy out there named Satan. And what I say to them is, you have to go back and say the same Bible that tells you about God tells you about Satan. So you have to recognize that, in fact, he's real, and he has very evil forces under his control. Those are the demons that we encounter. And spiritual warfare is a very real battle. And each of us is in a spiritual battle every single day. And that battle doesn't end when we come to know Christ as our personal Savior. In fact, the battle is intensified. The good news is that in that battle, we have an advocate. We have a commander or a commander-in-chief that has far more power than our enemy. But spiritual warfare is very real, and every one of us needs to accept that. Many of the things that we see happening today are a result of the spiritual battle that is occurring not only in our country, but around the world. And I think, Skip, I think you know that we all did some spiritual warfare while we were in Israel there with,
that's right,
with our enemy trying to stop us from accomplishing God's purposes.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the words that you shared, and I'm going to encourage our audience and give them the link to be able to hear it, is so poignant, and it really, I think, addresses some of the things you were just sharing of how poignant this spiritual battle is, and how we in the West just seem to close our eyes to both the threat to America, but more than that, the threat to our own souls.
Absolutely.
I want to go to 1993, and the reason I want to talk about Somalia is I was in Mogadishu with Samaritan's Purse for about a week, and we stayed at a compound there. The U.S. had infiltrated. We visited field hospitals, and what we were there for is inoculating children who were byproducts of the war. So I was there with Franklin Graham, and every 30 minutes, I remember at night, those Black Hawks would sweep down, the guns would be pointing. It's a very frightening, intimidating feeling for non-military American quote-unquote guest to be there. And what I discovered is that they found ID'd in the building next door to us a couple weeks later. And what I'm leading to here is you were there, and you were part of an operation that came to be known as Black Hawk Down. A film was made subsequent to that. I want to hear your insights, and I want to know, was that movie accurate from what you saw there?
Yeah. First of all, when I got off the plane in Mogadishu at the end of August of 1993, I will tell you, Skip, I felt the presence of evil. Now, you know, a lot of people don't really understand that, but just as surely as you feel the presence of the Holy Spirit in a worship service or at different times in your life, you feel God's presence through His Spirit. You can also feel the presence of evil, and I'm sure you experienced that while you were there.
Mm-hmm. That's very true, very accurate. It was something I hold with me to this day. I never saw the movie Black Hawk Down. I don't exactly know why, but there's just some feeling, memory that I don't want to revisit.
Absolutely, so I began to commit our soldiers and their mission there to a lot of prayer. We had a chaplain there, and we prayed and we sang God Bless America, and we really committed the success of our mission, but the safety of our soldiers to God. And right before I ordered the launch of that operation, I did as I had done every time. I got down on my knees and prayed and asked God to go with us and keep us in His hands, and we launched that operation. And 18 hours later, Skip, 15 of my soldiers were dead.
Oh.
And I watched on a small black and white television as their bodies, at least of some of them, were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu and mutilated and desecrated. Mm. And the first thing you have to ask is, what would cause people to be that way? What would motivate them to desecrate and mutilate bodies And I would tell you, it goes back to this whole concept of spiritual warfare. These people are overpowered by a demonic presence, a place where they have literally given over to the demonic influence there. Well, I will tell you, and I share this with audiences where I speak, Skip, my most vivid memory of Mogadishu was when that fight was over, and we brought our people back onto the airfield. A 5-ton truck came in on that airfield there where our base was in Mogadishu, and the dead were on the bottom, and the wounded were on top of the dead, and when we dropped the tailgate of that truck, the blood poured out the back of it like water.
Oh, my.
And I stood in absolute awe. I've never had a more devastating feeling in my entire life. I realized those were my soldiers. I realized that was their blood. And that evening, as I sat on my bunk and contemplated all that had happened, my anger grew. I was angry with God. I began to cry almost uncontrollably until finally I said, there is no God.
Hmm.
I said, God does not exist, and for 23 years I have been living a lie.
Hmm.
Because if there was a God, he would have been here, he would have heard my prayer, and he would never have allowed this to happen. And Skip, the moment I said that, I literally heard the voice of the Lord. And he simply said this. He said, if there is no God, there is no hope. And you know, Skip, I repented immediately. And I said, I am so sorry, God, that I denied you. And you know, there was another guy that denied God, but he denied him 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
We think back. So I only did it once. But I tell people that because I want them to understand that everybody is going to come to a crisis in faith at some point.
Mm.
But the good news is, before I even said I'm sorry, the moment it was in my heart, God forgave me.
Mm.
Because that's the God that we serve. He forgave me. And but then I said, you know, Lord, I still don't understand this. I just don't understand what happened here. And I said, I'm going to open my Bible. And wherever I open that Bible, I want you to give me something to help me understand what happened here. And I opened my Bible and Skip, this is the way God deals with me. I opened my Bible and I looked down and it said, trust in the Lord with all thy heart and lean not unto thine own understanding. Proverbs 3:5.
Yep.
So I had to go through a healing process. God gave me other scriptures that helped me with that. My family was very helpful, but God really drew me closer as a result of that, and I couldn't tell you today what that accomplished, what purpose it served, but what I do know is it was a lesson for me in spiritual warfare, because I believe that God revealed to me that our enemy there was not a physical enemy. Our enemy was a spiritual enemy that we were fighting, and that the battle that we were in served God's purpose in some way. And in retrospect, I'm very glad that I was there to be with those men when they died. I'm not happy that they died. I don't think I'll ever get to that point, but I'm glad that it was me that was there with them when they died, as painful as that was. To at least have had the opportunity to minister to them in some way.
Hmm. Jerry, those memories you have are so vivid, and they have to be, because as a soldier, what you've seen, what you've been through. But I got to tell you, it's so encouraging for us to hear somebody who's weathered the kind of storms you have as a leader and has seen what you've seen, but you have such a vibrant faith in God. And it's encouraging. I'm sure the people listening are going to be touched by that.
Well, thank you very much, Skip, and I'm blessed by that. And again, life is life happens, I guess is what I would say. But we are called to be warriors. We are called to stand in the gap. We're called to get our full armor on and to do battle. And And I'm only honored that God would give me that opportunity.
Well, let me shift to a modern threat. It's going on even as we speak. Since September 11th, 2001, Americans have learned that there are people out there, and a lot of them, who hate us and want to destroy us, and that's radical Islam. And you mentioned evil in the threads that we've been speaking about. There really is evil in the world, and it seems like in the West, we're not willing to identify that and call it evil, just a cultural difference. I'd like, from your perspective, to frame radical Islam and the threat against America.
Well, the first thing is that the West still considers Islam to be a religion, and we are hampered by our belief in the freedom of religion. The fact of the matter is the jihadist, the radical Islamist, believe that Islam is a way of life. It's not just a religion. As you well know, there can be no other law other than God-given law, mm-hmm. Sharia law. Therefore, it's a way of life. It's a political system. It's an economic system. It is their religion. But it is very difficult for us in the West to understand that. The second thing is the jihadist, their theology is founded in the Quran. And the people who read the Quran have to read the Quran understanding that the Quran was written in two parts. It was written in the part when Muhammad was in Mecca trying to build his religion, and then it was written, the second part of it was written when he was in Medina forming his army, ready to come back and conquer literally, you know, the known world, not just Mecca. And there are statements in the part of the Quran that were written when he was in Medina that talk about jihad and talk about what Muslims are required to do with regards to the infidels, which are the people of the book, or the Christians and the Jews. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, Skip, I'm more worried about this threat than I ever was about the Russians.
What will it take, General, for us to wake up in the West?
I think unfortunately, it's going to take something more devastating than 9/11.
Do you see that as a real possibility?
I think, Skip, it's going to happen.
It's just a matter of when.
It is a matter of when. It's going to happen. Hmm. And even then, there will be apologists. There will be those in the West who will find ways to make excuses for this and still talk about how this is just a small radical element. Well, the point is there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. And I would say that the overwhelming majority of those people do not wake up every morning wanting to kill infidels. Mm-hmm. They want to live in peace. But if only 1% of 1.5 billion people wake up every day wanting to kill the infidels, that's a lot of people. And it only takes a few of them to get into our country with the right kinds of capabilities to deal a devastating blow to us.
Right. If there's 15 million sworn enemies who will stop at nothing, including taking their own lives, and it took only 20 to bring down the Twin Towers, that's a formidable threat.
That's absolutely correct. And when you combine that with the what we know to be a problem with people being able to come into our country, and I'm not trying to get into the immigration issue, I'm simply saying as a statement of fact, we have somewhere between 11 and 12 million people in this country that came in illegally, so you have to wonder how many of those are Islamic extremists.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI, the last figures I saw, indicated that there were probably about 20 al-Qaeda cells in major cities across the country here planning for attacks against the United States. Now, that causes me a great deal of concern.
Sure. Hmm. General Boykin, three-star general, Virginia Tech graduate, evangelical Christian. You're retired from the military in active duty, but I have a hunch that you're not just sitting around playing golf, that you're a busy guy. Tell us how you're spending your time.
Skip, I teach at a men's college, which we have about 1,100 young men, and our task is to bring them from boyhood to manhood and to turn out young men of character. And I love that. It's a passion. But more importantly, I have founded a ministry. Our ministry is called Kingdom Warriors, and our website is www.kingdomwarriors.net. And we are almost every week, we are speaking at men's conferences and churches, and the whole theme is to encourage people to recognize that we're in a spiritual battle, to get their armor on, and to get in the battle.
And is your book available on your website?
The book is available on the website. It's called Never Surrender, and it's on the website, and it is really an autobiography and really a book about faith.
General Boykin, thank you for sharing your time with us, with our audience today. Real privilege to talk to you.
Skip, we'll be praying for you and your ministry, and thanks for all you do.
Thank you, sir. God bless you.
God bless you.